Now, you know you'll find CCTV cameras in most cities, especially London, but why on earth would you have them in the Nullarbor Plain, a desert? Well, some exciting news on that front from the outback, as far outback as you can get, on The Science Show, ABC Radio National. Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and we begin with some news from the British Science Festival just finished in Guildford about quantum computers using a single photon. Yes, take your solitary particle of light and insert. Sounds completely impossible, doesn't it? And the leader of the team that achieved this incredible result is an Australian, Professor of Physics Jeremy O'Brien.
So it shows for the first time a very small-scale quantum algorithm on a photonic chip, using single photons of light to encode quantum information and then implementing a very small-scale algorithm. And when I say small-scale, I mean it factors the number 15 into its prime factors. And any school kid can tell you what that is, probably quicker than our chip, but it's an important proof of principle.
Put this in context, the quantum computing is on a scale so much faster and bigger than any computers we can conceive. How much more powerful would they be once they're established?
Well, we say they're exponentially faster in the sense that as the number that you're trying to factor gets bigger and bigger, conventional computer, the time it takes to solve that problem grows exponentially, whereas for a quantum computer, it's exponentially faster than that. So if you go out, you know, if you make the number big enough, those two things diverge increasingly. So it's, you can't really say it's a million times faster or 100 million times faster, but, you know...
It can be. Okay, the big problem has been trying to get those quantum elements under control. Isn't that the real challenge with quantum computers?
That's exactly right. So these quantum systems that we encode the information in are inherently fragile, so we typically need to get very small or very cold or both in order to observe these unique quantum properties in a system. One of the big challenges is preserving the information that we encode in them and then, as you say, being able to control those systems. And we think this waveguide-on-chip approach is a really promising way to control single photon, single particles of light for this application.
It seems boggling to think of controlling single particles of light in any way, let alone in computing.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, when this scheme was first proposed back in 2001 by Kenneil Laflamme and Jared Milburn, who's at the University of Queensland, many people kind of regarded it as, okay, well, that's just mathematically, you know, proven to be possible in principle. But who really believes that you can operate a computer with, you know, single photons whizzing around at the speed of light? And over the, you know, the time since, so the last 6 or 7 years, I think it's become apparent that actually there's a lot of advantages to using single photons, and the key one is that they're very low noise, so they tend not to interact with their environment, in contrast to other systems like electron spin or a nuclear spin or an artificial atom or something like that, which tends to interact with anything else in its environment. So that's a real positive. The other great thing is that, as well as quantum computing, the other main quantum technology that people are interested in is quantum communication, and it seems pretty clear that photons are the only logical choice for doing that. And in fact, there are 4 or 5 companies around the world who will today sell you a quantum communication system, so it's just becoming a sort of commercial enterprise, these quantum technologies.
So using photons, you actually started your work at the University of New South Wales. How many different approaches are there around the world of different teams trying to crack this quantum computing puzzle?
I guess there's probably dozens of different ways that people are trying to do this, but it's widely regarded that 5 or 6 of them are sort of the leading approaches, and that's really quantified by the US government roadmap to quantum computing and the sort of funding that follows that roadmap. So there's sort of 5 or 6 leading approaches, and this photonics approach is one of them. And as I said earlier, photons are sort of already in the game in terms of the broader field of quantum technologies, in that they're essential for quantum communication. And so even if we don't ultimately realise a full-scale photonic quantum computer, it seems clear that we'll do some sort of small-scale processing, at least in these future quantum communication networks.
When you do have quantum computers, how will the world be different?
Well, I guess this big application of factoring is also the most difficult one, and the application of that is in cracking the encryption schemes that we use currently. So, you know, it's not just a mathematical abstraction factoring these large numbers.
You could crack any code in the world, couldn't you?
Well, at least the ones that are based on these large so-called semi-primes, so the product of 2 prime numbers. Now, that might not seem like a good thing, but obviously there are people out there who are interested in that. But the good news is that these quantum communication systems that we already have are not subject to that insecurity, so they have security that's based on the laws of physics itself. But that's really the very long-term goal, because you'd need a quantum computer of millions of qubits to do that sort of task. And I think it's fair to say that that's at least 20 years into the future. In fact, it's so far into the future that we can't even really make sensible predictions of when it might happen. But in the nearer term, we can extend these current quantum communication systems, which are currently limited to point-to-point communication, to something more like the internet we have today, where you have, you know, a network of different parties that can communicate securely. And there you'd need some nodes in that network that were able to, you know, relay signals and repeat signals and so on, and that would be a small-scale processor. And then going further into the future, there's prospects for simulating quantum systems with a quantum computer. And that's initially of somewhat esoteric interest to condensed matter physicists who have models of systems that, you know, that they can't exactly solve and so on. But it may be that we're able to use that approach to model important sort of materials, maybe even pharmaceuticals and so on, to provide an exact quantum simulation of them.
So put in the quantum description of anything and out could come that material or an object. The basis for Beaming Me Up, Scotty, perhaps. That paper by Jeremy O'Brien and his team from the University of Bristol was published in the journal Science. And while you're nutting that one out, try this one. All the stuff in the world, like you and me and the brick on which I just stubbed my toe, is only a small fraction of the matter of the universe. The rest is dark matter and dark energy. But what is dark matter? Alex Murphy from Scotland has just won the Lord Kelvin Award at the British Science Festival.
If we look at the constituents of the universe today, as we understand them, only about half of 1% is the sort of material that we know about and love, the stars, planets, that kind of stuff. About 10 times that, so about 5% or so of the entire universe, is made up of the gas, just normal gas, which lies between the stars and planets. Space is big, as Douglas Adams said at the start of his fantastic books. And so, even though it's very diffuse, those few little atoms and stuff between the stars, and that adds up to quite a lot. But then there's still a vast amount of other stuff, the dark energy and dark matter, which is of a completely different fundamental kind of particle.
How do you know that the mass is missing? Do you infer from the expanding rate of the universe that there must be something else to make up for the gap?
Essentially, if you look at a ball on a piece of an elastic going around, if you spin it faster and faster, the elastic stretches. And the amount it's going to stretch is going to depend on the weight of the ball. Now, we can look at the galaxies, it's much the same. The elastic is the gravitational force, the ball is the mass of the star, and you can see how it goes round. By comparing those two, we can see that either the elastic has to be an awful lot stronger, or there has to be a lot more star's mass around, so to generate that extra force.
It's a paradox, isn't it, that gravity isn't the same, doesn't behave normally in different places. You've got one interpretation of gravity, the Newtonian kind, in the solar system, and then you go further afield and it goes all awry, doesn't it?
Newtonian gravity works just fine on the scales of the solar system. General relativity also works fine on the scale of the solar system. They're completely equivalent when you're looking at those kind of objects at those kind of speeds. If you go to higher velocities and larger distances, Newtonian gravity starts to fail because it's an inexact theory. General relativity is still precise. However, even that appears to fail, but to keep it correct is what we're claiming is the required bit of dark matter.
And this is where the work you've been doing comes in. What is your candidate for dark matter and what it might be?
Our candidate comes from the extreme other end of scale. So the evidence for dark matter comes from looking at stars, galaxies, the entire universe as a whole. The solution comes from the very most fundamental physics of the smallest particles in existence. It's from advanced models of particle physics. And this is a solution that comes about completely independently of the dark matter problem. So that's an extra compelling element for it, that there's this solution just begging to be used, and we didn't have to invent it as such to do this.
So that's the candidate, but what is it?
All the normal matter that we're made of, if I hit my hand or something, I'm feeling the force of one set of protons and electrons and things bouncing into the other protons and electrons. Those are particles of what we call the standard model of physics. However, to understand why they have the characteristics they do and why there's the array of different particles that we see, we need another theory that says why as well as how. We have good indications of what it might be. What it suggests is that there's, in addition to all these normal particles that we know about, there's a whole mirror set of particles, which are basically the same things but with slightly different properties. And the lightest of those would be the particle that we're looking for. It's known as the weakly interacting massive particle, or the lightest supersymmetric particle, or the dark matter particle.
I see. So this is not like the electron and the positron, the mirror images of the standard particles that we know. It's something different.
Right, so there's the electron, and then there's the antimatter version of it, which is the positron. What we're talking about is a mirror to both of those, so that you then have a supersymmetric electron and a supersymmetric positron. So we've had to double everything.
So supersymmetry is the name of the game. This has been around for some time, but the evidence hasn't been there. How do you get the evidence? How do you get the proof to nail it?
Many people would claim that dark matter is the best evidence for supersymmetry. The fact that the universe moves as it does, that is beautifully explained by there being these supersymmetric particles around. How do you do this? Well, what we want to do is go down in a mine, and very, very rarely these things should interact with normal pieces of matter. That's what we're trying to do.
So you've got apparatus down in a mine and you're waiting for a ping. How will you know it's there?
How will we know it's there? Okay, so we set up an experiment. We go deep underground. The principal reason for that is because of the radiation of space, cosmic rays. You probably know about the aurora borealis. Or
you shield out all the other stuff by being down there. Yeah.
Absolutely, we shield out everything. So we make a detector that should see nothing whatsoever. And then we look to see if it's still seeing something. And if we do, and it has the right properties of those interactions, that will be our claim for dark matter.
So you don't need a Large Hadron Collider, you can just go down any mine?
Yes. The Large Hadron Collider is an interesting point to discuss, because they're also trying to search for dark matter. They're doing several other things as well. What we're trying to do is measure the dark matter that's floating around in the galaxies, has been there since the time of the Big Bang. What the Large Hadron Collider is trying to do is create new dark matter from high-energy interactions. So the two are very, very complementary. And if we could both find it and it has the same properties, that would be the confirmation that absolutely we found it, and that's the future of physics has been discovered.
Well, we've heard that the Large Hadron Collider won't be up and running at full strength for a couple of years, maybe even. Do you think you might beat it to the punch?
Hope so. There are people who wonder whether or not if the Large Hadron Collider should discover dark matter or... Well, they can never discover dark matter. They can discover the lightest supersymmetric particle. And from that, they would have to infer that it's also the particle that's responsible for dark matter. If they do find it, though, does that kill off our field? Not at all. I think that will only increase the need to confirm that it's the particle for the dark matter that makes up the mass of the galaxies. However, I think that there's a real chance we might well get there first. They probably should be running again. I believe it's something like November at the very first, and you're right, it'll take a couple of years to ramp up. When they have collisions, you've probably seen some pictures where there's splat on splat and a whole slew of stuff comes out, thousands of particles. To try and pull that apart and work out what happened in the main interaction is going to take a long time. It's going to be 2 or 3 years of analysis at the very earliest before they get to anything. That's giving us 3 or 4 years. Our detectors at the moment are right at the level where we think we might be about to see something. And we're building new detectors. We're about to start running next month with a detector that can go another factor of 10 further in sensitivity. There's a really good chance we're going to find it, and I hope we do.
And when you do, headlines?
It will be big. This has been recognised internationally, many different reviews, as probably the number one problem in physics, arguably in science. The problem's been there since 1932, 33, depending how you count, thanks to a guy called Fritz Zwicky, who first identified the problem. Nobody really believed him until the 1960s, where some other people did some other measurements and realised, hey, he was actually telling the truth. It's a big problem. It's one of the longest outstanding problems in physics. It will at least confirm our understanding of the universe as to what the constituents are. It will give us the first inklings of how to move beyond the standard model and to explain more fundamentally why the world is the way it is. Yeah, this will be big.
Alex Murphy with The Biggest Puzzle in Physics. He's a reader at the University of Edinburgh and was awarded the Lord Kelvin Prize at the British Science Festival just finished for his work. Well, at the start of this clearly cosmic science show, I asked you why they have CCTV, sort of, out in the Nullarbor. The reason is interesting and the result really exciting, as Nikki Phillips reports.
Scientists from Australia and Europe have discovered a bizarre type of melted meteorite in outback Western Australia. Head of the research, Dr. Phil Bland from Imperial College London, says they saw the meteor falling through the atmosphere with a new camera network they've set up across the Nullarbor.
This little network of cameras, many observatories out in the desert, out in the Nullarbor, and these things are looking up in the sky. They see basically the whole sky. So they can spot anything that's coming in, and then we get the data and we use that to triangulate the orientation of this thing in the atmosphere. And with that, we can work out what its orbit was before it hit the top of the atmosphere and also hopefully where it lands.
Phil says they spotted the meteor on the first night they used the camera network. And amazingly, they found it within 100 metres of where they predicted it would land. But this is no Armageddon-sized meteorite.
We found a couple of fragments probably together, I don't know, cricket ball size sort of thing.
And does it compare to other meteors that we've found on Earth?
Well, what's interesting about it is actually there's a couple of things that are interesting. It's the first one that we've ever got with an orbit in the southern hemisphere, which is nice. All the others are from the northern hemisphere. But there's actually only a handful that we've got orbits for at all. So we really don't know where many meteorites come from. We use meteorites to try and understand the origins of the solar system. They're the oldest rocks that we have. And we've got our work cut out if we don't know where any of them are coming from. So that's really the kind of gap that we're trying to fill.
Phil says this meteorite, which they've called Bunburra Rock Hole after a nearby landmark, doesn't come from the same region as most meteorites previously found on Earth.
Most meteorites, we think, come from the asteroid belt, which is basically a whole bunch of rubble, everything from dust to mini planet size that lies in between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. So it's this kind of ring of rubble debris that never managed to accrete, to clump together into a proper planet. Most meteorites, we think, come from the asteroid belt. Now, our little guy, it turns out, because we've got the orbit, we can track it back, and it comes from the very innermost part of the asteroid belt.
The discovery of a meteorite that came from the inner region of the asteroid belt is very exciting because it gives us a clue about the origin of all the other stuff and about the origin of our solar system.
One of my colleagues who's also on this paper had an idea a few years ago about where we originally made all of these melted asteroids. At the minute, when we look out in the asteroid belt, we see a completely unmelted object, something that's been cold its whole life, right next to something that's melted, right next to something that's the core of a little planet.
So you're saying in the asteroid belt at the moment there's lots of different type of rocks that are cold
exactly.
And hot, so there's
it's a
kind of higgledy-piggledy.
Higgledy-piggledy, exactly, mate. And it's always been a bit of a problem, and what this mate of mine said was, well, look, why don't we make the melted ones deeper in the inner solar system, around, you know, Earth and Mars and stuff. And they got made early, so there was a lot more radionuclide stuff, radioisotopes around. We don't have to worry about it today. They all finished their work a long, long time ago. But basically, it means you can cook stuff up very fast. And so they melted fast because of that. But there was a lot of other material around there, and then they got battered to bits, and it was only the survivors that made it out into the asteroid belt. Now, what's interesting about his idea is that he predicts using computer modeling that most of those survivors should be in the innermost part of the belt, which is exactly where our little guy comes from.
Phil says because the camera network trial worked so well, they're keen to set it up permanently.
At the minute we've got 3 or 4 cameras. We'd like to have something like, I don't know, 12, 14, similar to what some of these other networks have done. And with that, we'd be able to pull in not just 1 or 2 meteorites a year, but maybe a dozen. So basically every year we'd be doubling the number of meteorites with orbits, and we'd know where all these things come from, which would be great fun.
Phil Bland from Imperial College in London, Nikki Phillips reporting there, and you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National and poddable through abc.net.au/rn. Which takes us to Georgia, the place Russia keeps bothering, the one in East Asia, the terrain which has now produced bones of your ancestors, which are far older than anyone expected. So big a find that one of the skulls occupied the entire front page of the Independent newspaper in London and another 3 pages inside. A skull that rewrites the history of man, said the headline. This is Dr. David Lord Kipanidze, the director of the Georgian National Museum.
First hominids were found in 1991. It was human jaw, which provoked a lot of discussions and a lot of skepticism. It was very hard to imagine that you could find human fossils so early out of Africa, almost 1.8 million years old. And later, almost since 1999, we started to find every year either skulls or body parts. And today we could say we have almost two complete skeletons, and we have minimum six individuals. We have five skulls. Last skull has been found 2 years ago, but it is still not finished, the preparation and study. So I hope soon we will finish research and we will learn more about very early Homo who left Africa.
And all these skeletons are about 1.8 million years?
I would say they all are between 1.7 and 1.8 million some way. But the precise date would be around 1.75. But all they are from the same geological strata, and we think they could belong to one population.
Now, the idea was that Homo left Africa something like 900,000 years ago, so that's half the time.
The prevailing view maybe 20 years ago was that first documented presence out of Africa could be maximum 1 million years old, even less, you know, for the Europe. What I want to stress, this is a secure dating. We have several claims of the early presence hominids out of Africa, but it needs still to be proved. But I guess the human dispersal out of Africa happened much earlier than we have in the Manisi.
So that means that Homo would have left Africa on more than one occasion?
I'm sure, you know, I'm sure, and we know very little about these periods, and I think with the new sites which we are finding now, either in Georgia, either in Java, in China, and we have new finds now in Europe too, in Spain, so all will fill the gaps of our knowledge.
What do the people in paleontology and archaeology say about your discovery?
In 91, when we discovered this jaw, skepticism was very strong. But now I would say it's much less. Main discussions are about position of the fossils in evolutionary tree. And this will continue. The main topic is it Homo erectus? Or is it a new species? So I think this debate will continue, because we are learning more and more about this group. And big advantage of Tbanisi finds is we have whole population. We could compare different parts of skeleton, and this is was real dream for us.
Tell me what the place is like in Georgia. Georgia is where you come from, isn't it? It's a turbulent area where there's been lots of fighting, lots of warfare and upheaval. But what is your site like?
In 91, when we discovered first human remains in the Manisi, it was year of Georgian independence. So I would say maybe it's a coinciding that we came on the political map and paleoanthropological map same time, simultaneously. The site, the Manisi, is 80 kilometers from Tbilisi, and it's a very beautiful setting as whole Georgia is. And we found site below medieval setting, so it's a medieval city there. Absolutely, it's a medieval city with churches, with fortification system, and below it we found this early prehistoric site. Georgia is very rich with archaeological site. I'm sure all you heard about myth about Jason's watch, Jason, Medea, golden fleece, but I'm not sure everybody knows this is in Georgia, in western Georgia.
And Georgia is where the golden fleece really went from?
Yes, Georgia, western Georgia, Colchis, and archaeology proves it, you know.
And there's also a suggestion that wine came first from this region.
One of the earliest traces of wine, Neolithic wine, has been found. In fact, it's also in the same region where we found hominid skulls. It's 50 kilometers from there, where we found Neolithic settlement with the earliest cultivated wine. So this territory was settled since very early period. And also, I think archaeological evidence shows we were always part of the Western civilizations. We were always with Europe, and we want to be with Europe.
Well, this is highly significant because you want to be with Europe, and if we put the origins of some human ancestors there, does it mean that you could actually ascribe a Eurasian origin for our species as much as an African one?
I would be careful with so strong statement, but we could easily guess that origin of Homo erectus, one of the group of the Homos, could be in Eurasia and even in Caucasus, so this quite possible. So I think what we are getting now, the new evidence, is helping us to think more how little we know about human evolution.
Now, did this Homo erectus, if such it be, travel much, go back to Africa, possibly travel to the east in Asia?
I think it's not excluded that this early group of Homos, they were traveling, and their descendants has been found, I'm sure, in Western Europe too, or in Southern Europe, and maybe towards Asia. So it's not excluded that their descendants enlarged their home range.
What next for you? When will you have the final skull that you've discovered excavated and prepared?
I would say we excavated only 7% of this site, so there is a long work. The next step will be we will try to show to the public and to scientific community the position of old Manisi hominids in evolutionary tree, and particularly to discuss opportunity and possibility of variability inside of the species. Also, we have an ongoing project of studying in other sites, and who knows, maybe we will find something which will be a new surprise.
But what about this final skull that's still in situ, that's still...
That's why I think we are continuing to study of it, and I think it will give us questions exactly. Is the Manisi population one species, or we have different groups inside?
Dr. David Lord Kipanidze, the director of the Georgian National Museum, talking about the astounding fossil finds in Dmanisi, far older than anyone expected. Well, this week the aviation industry said it would cut its emissions of CO2 eventually in half. And one way is by using new fuels from plants. Naomi Fowler reports.
It sounds ideal. Algae are the world's most abundant form of plant life that literally eat up CO2. They can double their mass several times a day. If they're ever farmed successfully, they apparently won't compete with food production, water supplies, or contribute to deforestation. The boss of Continental Airlines thinks he's onto a winner.
There we go. These are drop-in fuels, meaning that you don't need to change the aircraft, you don't need to change the engines, we don't need to move to a new technology.
But environmentalist Jeff Gazzard of the Green Skies Alliance is unimpressed with this latest test flight.
All today's flight proves is that you can burn it in engines. There's nothing about production plants, there's nothing about the source, there's nothing about how soon and how much this is going to cost to make 238 million tonnes of fuel, which is currently the amount of kerosene that the world's commercial jet fleet consumes annually.
And it's bringing this product to market that's defeated scientists who've worked on algae for fuel in the past. The US government invested heavily in algae oil research in the 1980s. They closed it down when their scientists concluded production levels were too low to make it economically viable. But Peter van den Dorp of AlgaeLink says things have changed since then.
The reason that 20, 30 years ago this attention dropped was because the yield per hectare was totally out of reach. I think we have created three technology breakthroughs which have resulted now in productivity per hectare between 20 and 50 times higher than it used to be. All of a sudden, the economic models make sense.
Chief scientist for Greenpeace, Doug Parr, is sceptical about the claims some companies are making about the amounts of oil they can produce.
If you're trying to run a company on equity finance, you have to keep giving promising outlooks to keep raising the revenue. And it's not actually in your interest to show data if that data undermines the case about the speed of delivery into the marketplace. We're not against algae, far from it. We really would like to see it work. But we have to be sceptical about the claims made by corporations who might have other agendas than saving the planet.
Bioengineering scientist Dr. Krasen Dimitrov says he's done the sums and he thinks it's not a good investment. According to him, the laws of basic thermodynamics still mean the transformation of solar energy into biomass through photosynthesis can only ever operate within certain limits.
Photosynthesis only utilizes about 40% of the solar spectrum. Of this 40%, only 27% can theoretically be converted into biomass. But that has never been achieved. And there are a lot of companies that are trying to get closer and closer to this theoretical limit, but no matter what you do, That gives you the thermodynamic boundary of what you can achieve.
Therefore, he says, some of the yields of algae oil per hectare some companies claim they can now produce continue to contradict these simple laws of thermodynamics. The US government's National Renewable Energy Laboratory also concluded that using closed containers to produce the algae were too expensive to build and operate. I asked chemical engineer Dr. Helgart of Imperial College if he thought progress on huge open pond systems might fare any better.
You can ask yourself whether that is the best way of harnessing solar energy. Compared to sort of solar energy, it may be sort of one, maybe two orders of magnitude larger than what you would need.
You would need such a staggeringly large area to even start trying to service global needs. This is a big problem, isn't it?
Well, it is a big problem if you look at the overall efficiencies that are involved. They are, of course, slightly more complex because it is all well and good to grow the algae. You actually then have to invest a lot in actually extracting the oils and then transforming the oils into something that you can actually really use.
Peter van den Dorp of AlgaeLink insists closed systems are the way forward. He says the key to trying to make algae growing profitable is diversification.
The good news of algae in general is that it will always produce a combination of different products for different markets. So it's not just fuel. The good news with algae is that the commercial value of these byproducts is very high. So there will always be a spread of risk, and there will always be a weighted average in terms of end value, which is very appealing. And that's why we see that our customers continue to invest in this industry and in these products, irrespective of the existing oil price.
One claim often made about the production of algae oil is that it's carbon neutral. Dr. Helgart again.
Carbon neutral in the sense that you're building up biomass through the use of sunlight, water, and albeit nutrients. And I think that's where the conundrum might lie. We come into this whole fertilizer discussion, right? And where do the nutrients come from?
To get these high yields.
Yeah, exactly.
Greenpeace chief scientist Doug Parr believes it's now time for the European Union to officially verify whether or not algae growing, production into oil, and the burning of the algae as fuel really is carbon neutral.
Life cycle analysis is an important component of understanding what the climate impact of a new biofuel will be, and in the case of algae, that would include carbon emissions associated with growing, drying out, processing, transporting the fuel to a position where it can actually be used. If you look at European directives on biofuel, they have standards and even numbers that have to be put into life cycle assessments to see what the carbon saving is from, say, producing ethanol from sugar beet. And we think that there should be a similar approach for biofuel coming from algae so that we understand where we are with it and what the savings are.
From what you're saying, there needs to be quite a lot of independent monitoring of this whole growing industry. Do you trust governments to do that?
The EU has got some of the policy planks in place to make it happen. They've got a life cycle assessment, they've got mandatory standards. They've got some inspection and some auditing. We just need to make sure that we're not being sold down the river by the claims that the algae producers are giving us and that we get something that's genuinely sustainable and worthwhile.
Dr. Helgart.
There are also research projects on the way where you use waste, human waste, to grow algae. So one big issue is, can you upgrade waste treatment plants and use that as your nutrient source for the algae? Next to power stations or cement factories, where you've got a large source of rather concentrated CO2, then that again makes sense to grow your algae in the same sort of area.
What's your hunch about the future when it comes to global level for fuel from algae?
Ultimately, in my vision, it is a fuel for aviation purposes. Probably most other problems we can solve with electricity. I think it has been sort of stressed over and over again that we are looking now at a huge diversity of energy carriers in the future. And algal oil will play a role, will play a small role, and will have a niche market, but it will be there.
Millions of dollars are being poured into biofuel research, up from almost nothing a few years ago. According to Dr. Dimitrov, some venture capital investors like algae because it enhances their cutting-edge profile and their green credentials. And oddly enough, whether they're ever likely to work commercially may not be that important. They already receive a percentage fee for managing the investment. But for now, whether pond scum or green crude can live up to the claims made by some and the hopes of others has yet to be scientifically demonstrated. Naomi Fowler in London for The Science Show.
And I must say I was startled to see a huge advert promoting algal research in the British press, placed by Exxon. Anyway, aviation has many carbon strings to its reduction bow, including the silent aircraft from Cambridge, stronger, lighter materials, better air supplies for the cabins, and one to apply right now, sensible air traffic control. So, do you recognise this name? Phytophthora infestans, the mould that changed the world, causing potato blight in Ireland. Well, the little beast has just had its genome published in the journal Nature, and it shows just how it's managed to be so adaptable to the new potato strains through the ages. Paul Birch, I used to call this a fungus. Why not so now?
Well, it's actually a water mould, and in evolutionary terms, it's more distantly related to fungi than we are.
What's the crucial difference then between a mould, that water mould, and a fungus?
Well, genetically speaking, it has a very, very distant common ancestor. But if you look at it superficially, it behaves very much like a fungus. It has spores, it grows as a mycelium. So in evolutionary terms, it's evolved to do and look like it's doing many of the same things, but it's actually very distant.
I'll call it a water mould from now on, but what is the genome like, having made the announcement in the journal Nature? What have you found?
We found the genome is very large. It's expanded many, many times bigger than, for example, a fungal genome. And it looks like it's organised into two speeds, we've been calling it. So many of the genes that are in there which are conserved with other water moulds are clustered together, and there are not many repeats in the genome. And these are sort of residing in an ocean of repetitive sequence right the way through the genome. So they're very, very large repeat regions.
And that gives it a kind of reserve firepower to take on the potato. Whatever the potato's done, it can then do something to infect it still, despite the new resistance.
Yes, it would appear that many of the genes in this water mould that are to do with its ability to infect potato are actually residing in these very repetitive regions of the genome. This means that they can evolve faster.
How similar is this one that you've elucidated to the one that was responsible for the potato famine in the mid-19th century in Ireland that changed all sorts of populations, including the Australian population, I mean, as well as the American one? We've got all sorts of Irish all over the world as a result of having to escape that terrible blight. How similar are the two Phytophthora infestans?
Well, it's the same species. Without actually being able to sequence the whole genome of some of those ancient samples, it's hard to categorically say it's a brother or sister, but it's basically the same species.
You've still got some samples, haven't you, from the blight?
There are, yes. Some in the Natural History Museum, and I think in one of the research institutes here in Rothamsted, there are some ancient infected leaf samples from the 1840s.
Now you've got the genome, how useful will it be to take on this very, very clever mould?
Well, it's revealed to us all of the genes that it needs to infect a potato. Those particular genes produce proteins that are exposed to the plant's immune system. And therein that lies an extraordinary evolutionary battle between potato and Phytophthora. What we're looking for are some of these proteins from the pathogen which are maybe less able to evolve, that may be constrained in some ways, that we could actually target the immune system of the potato towards.
You can look at the vulnerabilities in the barcode and try to zap them, but there are lots and lots and lots of different sorts of wild potato. I remember looking at how they evolved in the Andes, because at each level in the mountainside there'd be a different kind
adapted to a different sort of microclimate. So you've got a huge variety of potatoes. Were they all with their own lurking Phytophthora waiting for them?
It's hard to say that all of them are in the perfect environment for Phytophthora infestans to work at its best, but certainly a huge range of different wild potato species in a lot of different climates in South and Central America are co-evolving with this organism.
And it's still deadly, isn't it? It's still somehow able to wipe out crops. Like in Papua New Guinea, didn't they wipe out the whole crop there?
Yeah, I think that was a couple of years ago. They'd not had any Phytophthora in there. Was introduced by whatever means. It spread through Papua New Guinea and destroyed the crop very rapidly in a way that was reminiscent of what happened in Ireland. So today it's very difficult to have naturally resistant potatoes grown in monoculture that will stand up to the pathogen. So people tend to spray the crops and spray them very regularly in order to control the disease.
And what about the response of the people in various parts of the world to your publication? What do you think the ripple's going to be like?
I would hope that people, especially in the farming industry, would be interested to know that we have this blueprint and we intend to use it to try and defeat this pathogen if we can.
Knock it on the head. But next, finally, you've got next year the genome of the potato, is that right?
Yes, 2010, 2011 maybe. There's a bit of slippage there, but I believe that researchers are looking at both potato and tomato genomes, both of which are hosts of this pathogen. Those genome sequences will be coming along. Yeah.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Birch is at the University of Dundee in Scotland, and his paper was published last week in the journal Nature. Plenty of research being done in that field in Australia as well, not least in Melbourne at La Trobe University. Marilyn Anderson and Kim Plunner work on fungi, but on other plants as well, with all kinds of properties like hurrying up childbirth. Marilyn Anderson is Professor of Biochemistry at La Trobe.
Accelerated childbirth, well, this is an area we got into when we were studying a natural tribal medicine from the Congo region in Africa. And the story started when the Red Cross were there, when the wars were on in the Congo, and a doctor discovered that the families were coming to visit women in labour and were smuggling in a tea, and the women had this tea, and then the childbirth would accelerate and would be out of control. So this Norwegian doctor took this tea home, or found the plant, it was called Calata calata, and extracted the molecule and found it was a very interesting and new molecule. David Craik subsequently in 1995 found it was a cyclic peptide, a tiny little peptide, and that it was able to irritate the uterus enough to accelerate childbirth.
I see. So has that been exploited to use it in a clinical sense?
Well, David is trying to exploit it to use it in a clinical sense, but not to accelerate childbirth, because it turns out that a lot of molecules stimulate childbirth because the uterus is a twitchy organ. But actually, the thing that was exciting about this molecule was that they could boil the plant, prepare a tea, and that the women could take this orally and it would work. And this suggested that it was absorbed. And so David Craik's group in Queensland is interested in having this as an oral pharmaceutical, and he wants to use this molecule to graft other activities on it. So his dream is to have an oral insulin or some other molecule that can be taken, you know, that doesn't have to be injected.
Have you been involved directly yourself?
Our role has actually been to see why does the plant make this molecule, because obviously plants aren't interested in women having more rapid childbirth. And so we extracted the molecule and actually found out how it's made, because this is the first cyclic molecule ever found that's gene encoded. We discovered that. And then we went aside and said, well, why are the plants making it? And we found that they're really potent insecticidal molecules. When we first did this, we thought we'd feed some insects this molecule, and we had a little artificial diet, and we put some caterpillars in with the artificial diet, and they did everything they could to escape. They ate their way out of the container, and the first three experiments failed until we found a way of keeping them in there. And then we found that they would take a taste, and then they would just not eat anymore, and they failed to grow. So it's a very efficient insecticidal molecule.
How wonderful. Of course, tremendous source of these chemicals. But before you introduce me to Kim, how do you two combine your work together?
Well, my interest with Kim are with another set of naturally occurring plant molecules, but these are molecules that protect plants against fungal disease. And specifically, the molecules I'm working with here are molecules from flowers, because it's very important that flowers are not infected, because it's really important that they produce seeds and go on to make the next generation. So we're finding that flowers are very rich in natural antibiotics. And so we went ahead to try and isolate these molecules, and we found one that was really very effective. And now my lab is trying to understand, why is it that it kills a fungus? So we're trying to understand exactly how it works. But we needed to go and talk to Kim, because she's an expert on fungi and how a plant interacts with a fungus, and we really needed a highly trained fungal plant pathologist.
Hello, Kim.
That's where I step in. Oh, goodness. So, yes, we're looking specifically at how the molecules that Marilyn's isolated from those flowers go about their business in attacking the fungus and killing the fungus off, and indeed killing a range of different fungi as well.
Any successes so far?
Absolutely. Majority of the fungi that have been looked at so far have actually been found to be killed by this molecule. And we're looking at various different mechanisms to dissect the interaction. And one of Marilyn's students, Nicole van der Weerden, has done some really nice work in looking at biochemically treating fungi to work out what perhaps the molecules from the plant bind to on the fungal surface. And we've had some other students who are working away at being able to biochemically treat and look at different layers of where the protein might bind to. And we're also looking at modifying the genetics of a particular fungus to see if we can try and get at the genes involved with the structures that the plant proteins attack, to then try and dissect how that's getting in and how that's working.
Of course, plenty of agricultural products are vulnerable to such things. I was going to say Phytophthora infestans on potatoes, but you're going to tell me it's not a fungus.
That's true. That's right. It's not a true fungus, as was previously believed. The classic fungal pathogen is no longer accepted as being a fungus. But yes, a lot of these plant pathogens, including fungi and oomycetes, which Phytophthora infestans is an oomycete, a lot of these pathogens have been and are fundamentally controlled by chemicals. And various different chemicals have been used and are the primary weapon against plant diseases to this date. Fungi and other plant pathogens are really good, however, at overcoming different chemicals. They have very plastic genomes. They're vast populations of pathogens with the ability to mutate to overcome the mode of action of those different chemicals.
Like bacteria in hospitals and us.
Precisely. Exactly like bacteria and their ability to overcome or to mutate and change, and thereby be no longer able to be targeted by an antibiotic. So the process of mutation, it's quite a natural process that happens. And if the mutation ends up resulting in the fungus being able to avoid that interaction with that chemical, or indeed avoid recognition by a naturally occurring resistant plant, then you get a fungus that's more effective in causing disease.
Just checking as you've knocked down one of my icons, my iconic funguses, what about the ones that attack vines in vineyards, which you, well, treat in the old-fashioned way with copper sulfate? Are they still fungi?
They are. So, well, actually, the two different major fungi that attack, or two different pathogens, I should say, that attack grapes. The classic botrytis that gives us the lovely botrytized, sticky, sweet, yummy wines. A bit of a friend and a foe. That's a true fungus. But the downy mildew that attacks grapes also is not a true fungus. So that also is an oomycete. So it's been kicked out of the true fungi.
Back to yourself with the biochemistry. What's your next stage in this quest to keep one step ahead of these amazing creatures?
Well, first of all, as Kim said, we're trying to actually understand exactly how this molecule works, so that if a fungus does become resistant, we understand exactly how that happens. But we're not restricting ourselves to this molecule. We're looking at other naturally occurring plant molecules that are toxic to fungi, and then we're trying to find ones that work by different mechanisms of action. And so the ultimate aim is that we will use combinations of molecules so that if a fungus becomes resistant to one, it will still be affected by the other one.
Is there a scale of financial impact that occurs to you in Australia, say, how many crops are knocked off because, in the classic sense, even though it's not a fungus, the one that used to be a fungus, change the course of history in Ireland, as we all know.
Actually, Kim and I were talking about this before we came to talk to you and said, just what are the losses? And we've discussed it. The losses vary from year to year. Sometimes they're just happy to get a crop at all. And so Kim was saying that quite often in the best season for the best crop is also the best season for fungal disease. So you may lose 20% of the crop, but you still get enough to go on with. Other years you might lose the entire crop, and then that's especially devastating. You know, that's especially true for small crops where there's not the same amount of research gone into developing the ideal chemical, or organic crops where they're only dependent on copper and that doesn't always hold the fungus.
And there they are in the soil, standing by almost forever, because soil is such a complex thing, and I suppose they can last for thousands of years if they want to.
Well, it depends on how they survive. Some fungi require a host, and so they need a living host to be available pretty much all the time. A lot of them have developed survival structures so that they can survive in the soil for 10 or 15 or more years. Often those pathogens are the ones that are most difficult to control because they've got those nice survival structures that hang out in the soil. Another major issue with a lot of the pathogens that we work with is how specific they are in terms of the plants that they will infect. One of the pathogens that I work with, Sclerotinium, it produces one of these little resting structures that survive in the soil for many years. It can infect just about every broad-leafed crop species that we grow. Many of the broad-leafed fruit and vegetables and the broad-leaf crops, such as canola, are susceptible to Sclerotinia. So because this one species of fungus can attack so many different hosts and devastate many of those different crop species, it's quite hard to understand how it's actually working, and therefore any kind of control that would be useful for one crop could have many different applications for other crops as well. Another pathogen I work on just infects apple. It infects apple and very closely related species of apple, crab apples.
It comes from New Zealand, perhaps.
It's all over the place.
Indeed. Mustn't always blame the New Zealand.
No, indeed not. In fact, I worked for 10 years in New Zealand, so we should be very careful about our buddies overseas, and I still collaborate with them on that particular apple pathogen. So there are lots of different types of pathogens, and the way they survive and the way they grow and how plants can defend themselves against those pathogens is very much a part of what I'm doing and the work with Marilyn is involved with.
And the question I put before, the scale of the reward, should you have success, what was the figure that occurred to you?
With something like the protein that Marilyn's laboratory have developed, it could have a very broad spectrum range of pathogen that will be able to be controlled by this, and therefore I wouldn't like to even attempt to estimate it, but it could be extremely valuable for such an impact.
How long will it take to get it into the field?
It's actually been in the field already. So as a spin-off of our work, we have a biotechnology company called Hexima, and we've had 3 years of field trials with transgenic cotton. And I shouldn't say that we were surprised, but we were surprised. We could see an effect. We could see an effect from the air. First time I've ever done an experiment where we could look at results from the air, and we saw protection. So we're still working on it, of course, but we're very encouraged. And we've started a new project in collaboration with Pioneer DuPont to try to make corn more fungal resistant. And of course, that's a very valuable crop worldwide.
Marilyn Anderson, Professor of Biochemistry at La Trobe University in Melbourne, with botanist Kim Plummer. Next week, more clever birds solving problems and buffalo in the Northern Territory. Also, watch out for your prostate if you have one, or your partner's if you share one, on Catalyst coming up, ABC One on television. Production for The Science Show by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, for they are sticking to their diets. Laugh we may at this modern wisdom, but my next guest on our creative thinking series, Susie Orbach, says it's now way out of hand.
Now we no longer see the body as biological. We see it as something that we have to shape, as though the body was simply a dress or a kitchen or something that could be in our own image.
You can join Susie Orbach and myself, Geraldine Doogue, by downloading Saturday Extra from the Radio National website.